I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the heart of the Middle East in the UAE on the 82nd anniversary of the single largest battle in the history of warfare, the Battle of Kursk, where Russia defeated the Nazis. Today, though, in Kiev, neo-Nazis will celebrate Ukraine's National Flag Day with the EU-UK armed far right opposing Zelensky's concessions to Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin. This despite Russian hackers claiming Ukraine documents show 1.7 million Ukrainians are dead or missing since 2022. This after a week when the subservience of NATO countries to Donald Trump was put on show for the world. A posse of seven European viceroys, Rutte, von der Leyen, Starmer, Stubb, Macron, Merz and Maloney, genuflected to Trump after he rolled out the red carpet for Russian President Vladimir Putin in the USA. 10 out of 10, Trump called the meeting. Putin, for his part, has been briefing leaders of the BRICS and Shanghai Cooperation Organization. So let alone questions about Ukraine, could Alaska's Putin-Trump meeting signal a new era of nuclear detente and the world edging away from nuclear Armageddon? Joining me again from Washington, D.C. is Professor Anatol Levin, director of the Eurasia Program at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. He's a former senior associate for foreign and security policy at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and was on the academic board of the Valdai Discussion Group across the 80s and 90s. He worked as a journalist in the former Soviet Union, other areas of Eastern Europe and in South Asia. Anatol, Professor Levin, thanks so much for coming back on. Apparently, I'm being told there's some glitches between the UAE and Washington, D.C. I don't know what geopolitical consequences I should judge from that. But let's just begin. Why do you think scholars, journalists, policymakers across Western Europe, perhaps in the Beltway in Washington where you are, seem to be against even the idea of Trump convening the Alaska summit, well aware that even if that Russian hacking group estimate of 1.7 million they claim to reveal, certainly hundreds of thousands, have been killed in this war in Europe? Why don't they even want Georgia?
Well, I think there's a bad reason and a good reason. I mean, the bad reason is that they have nailed themselves individually and collectively so firmly to the idea that this war must end in a complete Ukrainian victory. And they've nailed themselves to the idea that Putin is the embodiment of all evil, and that he plans, if not stopped, to conquer the whole of Europe. But it's very difficult for them now to do a U-turn on that and accept that, you know, a deal is possible without, frankly, looking bloody stupid. And when you've got, you know, whole establishments, not just governments, officials, but newspapers, television stations, think tanks, all of which have been saying exactly the same thing for 3 years. Difficult to get them to change. The good reason, I suppose, is that some of them at least are genuinely convinced of the Russian danger and believe, therefore, that you've got to keep the war in Ukraine going, because otherwise, if it comes to an end, Russia will rebuild its armed forces, strengthen itself, and threaten Europe. I myself regard this as utter nonsense, but I do know that there are a lot of people in Europe who genuinely believe this.
Yeah, just as I was reading the intro to this show, I saw Poland's defense minister confirming a Russian drone had struck Poland, saying a Russian provocation. I mean, do they understand that very well, that they're telling Trump? I mean, here's the Japanese FT. Trump hints at U.S. air role in push to seal Ukraine peace. Are they busy trying to set up a tripwire here? And do they really believe von der Leyen, Starmer, Stubb, Macron, Merz, Maloney, the editor of Going Underground, who hails from where I do in Britain, says not to call them the dwarves. It's wrong to call them dwarves and not professional. Do they really think that the minute one step over the border after any peace agreement, that's it? There's going to be war on Russia. Is that what their mindset is?
Well, that, I must confess, is what I don't fully understand, because every government has said, including the Biden administration, by the way, that they will not go to war with Russia. European public opinion is against it, if you look at the opinion polls. The Europeans do not have the ground forces. They've got ample forces to defend themselves. But if you look at the countries that are actually suggesting this reassurance force for Ukraine, the troops that they can put into an expeditionary force are pitifully small. The British former Army Commander General Dannett has said that just to provide one brigade for Ukraine would be, you know, if you look at rotation and training and R&R, would essentially take the whole of the British Army to do that. Which would mean, by the way, stripping Poland and the Baltic states, which are NATO members, of British support. So it's, yeah, I mean, they are obviously hoping that this would act as a deterrent to Russia. But on the other hand, what is even weirder is that they are justifying huge increases in European military spending with the idea that, as their phrase goes, Russia could test NATO states. Well, now, the Baltic states are NATO members. We have a treaty obligation to defend them. So does the United States as members of NATO. Ukraine is not a member of NATO. And by the way, when Zelensky asked when, before the war, when can you guarantee that Ukraine will be a member of NATO, they all said, no, we can't give any guarantees. So look, if I don't believe that Russia does want to test NATO, but it should be pretty obvious that if you put a NATO force into Ukraine, that is where Russia would test us.
Yeah, Russia said they're not going to allow that. And there are a few glitches continuing here between our connection, but I will persevere. Does it not occur to any of them, and Putin has raised this flag years ago, that surely what would solve it is if Russia was invited to join NATO, not Ukraine. But if Russia was joined to join NATO, that would solve it all.
Well, I mean, that's what people should have thought about in the 1990s. You know, either freeze NATO expansion or abolish NATO and create a completely new security architecture in Europe. Or yes, I mean, I'm not sure that inviting Russia to join was ever really realistic. But the thing is, you know, those of us who are a certain age can remember Gorby mania, you know, the adulation of Gorbachev in the West. But it seems that since then, we've forgotten everything that Gorbachev said about the need for a common European home, how, you know, rival alliances must not threaten each other, how security in Europe is indivisible. And we've replaced this with the idea that you can create a order in Europe without Russia, and indeed against Russia. And I mean, one way of looking at this is to say that, you know, we basically, like in one of the Western films, we threw Russia out of the saloon, and Russia is now trying to shoot its way back in.
Yeah, it's been my misfortune to be on a TV show with Jonathan Powell, the advisor to Sir Keir Starmer, and on a show with Sir Keir Starmer. But did it not occur to him or to any European leader that they, their own country might look bigger if they hosted a Trump-Putin summit rather than Trump having to have it in Alaska? Would that not occur to them as sovereign countries themselves to conduct something within Europe? I mean, why would that not be? Because, you, as you say, just because they think Putin is the embodiment of all evil.
Well, it's also because, you see, the Poles and the Balts would block it. And all of these countries, for one reason or another, have consciously or unconsciously devolved a lot of their sovereignty over the years to Brussels and to Washington via Brussels, you know, via NATO. And then, of course, you have the ambition of Macron in France and the French establishment to lead a united Europe, that this will be some kind of great power, but of course under French leadership. Well, at that point, everybody is terrified of irredeemably splitting Europe. And what that means is that you have handed a veto to countries in Eastern Europe. Now, look, you've got to understand the paranoia of the Poles and the Balts and the hatred of Russia, given, you know, what happened to them in the past. But as I always say, you know, you have to sympathize with and understand in your own lives, the attitudes and the fears of somebody who has suffered a crime, a terrible crime, at the hands of somebody from a particular ethnic group. But that doesn't mean that you have to agree with them. This kind of sympathy is not the same as agreement. And frankly, by handing over a lot of European strategy to former victims of Russia and giving them a veto over European behavior, we have endorsed attitudes which are not in the interest of a majority of Europeans.
Except, Professor, though these leaders who were looking so subservient at the White House are themselves incredibly unpopular. The Finland disapproval rating for Stubb, 65%. Macron, you mentioned, 80% don't like him. Germany, 76% don't like Merz. Meloni, 73% don't like her. In Britain, 81% don't like Starmer. At the same time, some recent polls show great popularity for Zelensky. I know that the media in Western Europe is highly censored. Obviously, they can't get access to... I mean, Britain doesn't even now give a license to Fox News. They've stopped applying for a license there, let alone RT and other media. Is that partly to blame, or why is it the peoples of these countries actually genuinely do see Putin as an enemy?
Well, they do see Putin as an enemy up to a point, and they certainly have great sympathy for Ukraine and Zelensky. But of course, that's not at all the same thing, if you look once again at the polls, as saying that they are willing to go to war attacks then. But yes, I mean, this leaders and governments are very unpopular at home, and they're trying to build up their popularity, as so governments so often do, by striking, tough poses on the international stage. The other thing, of course, is that Trump is very unpopular in Europe. Now, that leaves the European governments with a very fine line to tread, because on the one hand, they gain popularity at home by standing up to Trump. On the other hand, they all know perfectly well that, or at least they believe, that Europe is dependent on America for security. I mean, all this talk about a European reassurance force for Ukraine, if you take Starmer's statements, it's always been accompanied by a statement or followed by a statement that this can only happen with a US guarantee and US backup. And Trump on that has gone to and fro and to and fro, not really sure where he stands. But so, they spend some of their time posing against Trump for domestic audiences. Then they go to Washington, and frankly, they grovel in the most humiliating fashion. But this is because, for years and years and years, they outsourced their security to the United States. And now they're trying to get it back, but they don't really know what to do with it because they're not used to thinking actually in terms of their own national security.
Professor Anatol Levin, I'll stop you there. Apologies for the glitches there. More from the director of the Eurasia Programme at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the director of the Eurasia Programme at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, Professor Anatol Levin. Professor Levin, you were talking about the outsourcing of Europe's security, which has happened over many decades. Is that why they don't even understand, perhaps, that Putin might suggest Chinese peacekeepers to be in parallel with these European peacekeepers? And the fact is that they've allowed China to, China, the government in a way, is at stakes in 30 port terminals in NATO countries, Britain's busiest port, Holland, Belgium, Italy, Greece. Britain's nuclear capacity is owned by China. Do they understand? Because they don't even seem to mention that Russia might want security guarantees. Do they not think that Russia would need any security guarantees in parallel with the ones they desire?
That's been the key problem, you know, from the word go in the 1990s, that there has been a total inability and unwillingness to see things from Russia's point of view. Even though, I mean, this is really not difficult. I mean, it's not like trying to understand, I don't know, the Taliban, who, you know, genuinely do have a very different culture and attitude to life. I mean, the Russian establishment's attitudes to security are, believe me, very, very close to those of the US security establishment. And as has often been said, you know, I mean, what's the Monroe Doctrine about? We know how America would react if a potentially hostile military alliance tried to establish itself on the continent of North America. How do we know? Because we've seen how America has reacted. Now, in the past, they invaded countries. I don't know whether they would do that, but we know from so many past and very recent examples that if Mexico tried to form a military alliance with China, the United States will do everything in its power to overthrow the government, destroy the economy, support rebellions, provoke ethnic conflict to the point of genocide if necessary. America would do all these things because it is not willing to see a hostile and powerful military alliance on its borders. Why is it so hard to understand that Russia does not want to see that either? And that, you know, therefore you have to try to reach a compromise. Now, of course, that doesn't mean simply handing Ukraine to Russia, let alone, you know, handing over Eastern Europe. Not that Russia actually wants Eastern Europe back, but it does mean trying to understand the other side's point of view and reach a reasonable compromise. Now, as to China, well, there, I mean, Europe is in a total shambles, partly because for years and years it committed itself, as did America, of course, to this idea of totally open borders, open trade, open investment. Now the world is swinging radically against that, led by the United States, and Europe is scrambling to catch up. I mean, for many years, there was no serious attempt to defend European industry against China, or indeed anywhere else. There wasn't even certainly in Britain, any kind of preference when it came to government contracts for British firms. So there was no understanding of China as, I mean, not exactly a geopolitical threat to Europe, is a long way away, but certainly a real, you know, and formidable economic competitor. And therefore, as well, there was no understanding that it's in Europe's interest to try to, you know, maintain a distance between Russia and China instead of driving them completely together, which is what Western policy has managed to do.
Yeah, I mean, Trump unilaterally, it seemed to be unilateral, although Ursula von der Leyen was there, just suddenly put 15% tariffs on Europe. That's while here in the UAE, it says how UAE-Russia are forging stronger ties. This is in Gulf News in the Dubai Press. High-level visits, growing trade, shared diplomacy. It's all happening with Russia and the rest of the world. Do you think it'd be smarter of Putin to have suggested himself that the European peacekeeping force should be put there, given that the Europeans anyway, they're going to bankrupt themselves spending $100 billion on US manufactured weapons for Ukraine, led by Zelensky or Zaluzhny or whoever, and just allow these peacekeepers to be there. And as you say, they rely anyway on the United States, which definitely doesn't want any hot war with Russia, and just allow them to just stick around, wander around. Or is it too dangerous? They really would act as a tripwire and try desperately to get the United States involved in a hot war with Russia?
Well, look, on the one hand, I think there is a really strong case for Russia trying to wait as far as Europe is concerned, because you mentioned how unpopular it's not just the present governments of Europe are, but the establishments in all these countries. You know, we could well be looking in future, starting with the French elections of 2027, at, you know, radical political change in Western Europe, leading potentially to very different attitudes to Russia, to NATO, to the European Union, to all of these things. But as to a European force, I'm afraid that the Russians have nailed themselves so firmly against this that it would be extremely difficult for them to change. And also, what they're afraid of is that if you had a force like that in Ukraine, there might be Ukrainian extremist forces, hardline forces, that would try to cause a new war. Because, you know, this is likely to be a very, if we can get a ceasefire, you know, there are bound to be exchanges of fire across the line, clashes, provocations. And, you know, one could well imagine Ukrainian forces who would say, right, you know, now we've got European forces here, let's try to do something that will get the Russians to attack us or attack them, and then, you know, which of course the Ukrainians have always wanted, drag NATO and the West into a war in order to defeat Russia and reconquer Ukraine's lost territories. I mean, that may be a bit paranoid on the part of the Russians, but it's not, you know, it's not totally, it's not completely paranoid.
Yeah, you stopped short of saying MI6 false flag there, clearly. I mean, obviously, waiting it out for all these, as you call them, ridiculous leaders who are in Washington to eventually leave the stage is one thing, but how many more poor Ukrainian families will have to be bereaved for that time? I mean, how stable are these countries anyway? The countries led by Starmer, Stubb, Macron, Mertz, Maloney. How stable are they, especially when so much of their funds are going to be being sent for this Trump-Putin peace plan?
Yes, well, first of all, I mean, just to echo what you said, I mean, what has been forgotten by the West, or well, actually mostly forgotten, not entirely, is that, you know, keeping this war going means people dying, people being crippled. You know, there are human costs, which are not, of course, being paid by Western politicians or commentators. But, you know, some people in the West say openly that because they say Russia is a threat to Europe, we want to keep this war going as long as possible so that Russia can't attack us. But what this is basically saying is, you know, so that we shouldn't have to worry, we're willing for endless numbers of Ukrainians to die. Well, I mean, I suppose you could call that a realist position, but then so many of these people also prance about claiming to be great, you know, moralists and defending international morality and legality. So anyway, I just thought I'd put that in. But as far as these European countries are concerned, I mean, a lot of this looks like pure bluff. I mean, I was touring Western Europe. I didn't meet any non-official expert or commentator in private and off the record who believed that Europe could generate anything like the increases in military spending that they've promised to Trump, given the pressure on budgets and given the state of their economies. Because various finance ministers have started to say, for that, we will have to cut radically social welfare spending, health spending. Well, the Starmer government tried to do that, and what happened? There was a series of parliamentary revolts. The German government tried to do that, parliamentary revolts. The populations won't stand for it. But secondly, this has been sold to European publics under two guises. The first, that, you know, if you don't have these huge military increase, and not just Ukraine, it's actually going to come for Britain and France, Well, you know, I'm not sure that anyone really believes that. I mean, one Russian friend joked that Britain's perfectly safe because if the Russian army ever got to Paris, it would never leave it again. It would be so happy it would just stay there. He didn't say that they were going to get to Paris. But the other thing is, of course, then, because they can't produce the arms themselves at the moment, and because they're desperate to please Trump, actually, what have they promised? They've promised to spend, what is it? 600 billion euros on American weapons. Now, they had said to European publics that military spending was going to be used to create a wonderful new, you know, industrial regeneration of European industries. And what are they actually doing? They're buying American weapons. Well, you know, I mean, you don't have to be some kind of political expert to see through that one.
Yeah, and anyway, some of the statistics have road building as part of American, part of the contribution to NATO. Just finally, do you think Sergei Lavrov was signaling something when he said that, and to prove that far be it from Russia desiring more land, they're the largest country already, there is a possibility that Trump could just explain to these Western European leaders, you've got to legalize the Russian language, and stop the bombing of Donetsk, and somehow then you could have Chinese and whatever European peacekeeping force, and there's no need for even Russia to take over some of these Russian-speaking areas of eastern Ukraine, because it was really all about the ethnic cleansing attempt, the bombing of Donetsk, the outlawing of the Russian language also, which has been happening in Latvia, it should be said, and that would calm things down.
Well, I mean, all of these things, you know, hang together. They're, you know, they're all going to have to be sorted out in this final peace settlement. But what I think does need to be said is that we want Russia to commit itself as firmly and legally as possible to freezing whatever agreement we finally get on territory. And one way of doing that is to place all this under an international treaty signed by Russia, under the United Nations, also signed and endorsed by China, and indeed by BRICS and India and other countries, to make any agreement as solid as possible internationally, globally, not just the West. The West keeps talking about itself as if it was the whole world. Well, we aren't. You know, we need the rest of the world in to legitimize an agreement and to try to hold Russia and Ukraine, by the way, to whatever is agreed.
Professor Anatol Levin, thank you. And that's it for the show. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Monday with the former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, who has been publicly condemning the US-UK-EU armed Israeli genocide in Gaza. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.